So I'm talking about Reynolds Gas Dynamics, which is a title that you already know about, I think, and schedule. I'm Chuck Lee from the LLNL, stands for Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which is run by the University of California, but the money comes from the Department of Energy. So by Reynolds Gas Dynamics, what I mean is gas dynamics, but in which Reynolds presses are important, which means I'm talking about turbulent gas dynamics, effectively. Let me start with just the simplest form of gas dynamics without the turbulence. A gamma law gas is there's an equation of state for it. It gives the pressure in terms of the internal energy, specific internal energy here, a density. Gas pressure is given by this expression. Gamma is the polytropic index. It's the ratio of the specific heats. And this is the expression for such an equation of state for gamma law gas. But now, a Reynolds gas, as I mentioned, is one in which the turbulent eddy stresses are important. And I'm going to take the simplest possible case to talk about, and that is a homogeneous isotropic turbulence, where we have a stress tensor, given here, familiar to all of you. And this is given as, this is essentially a diagonal multiple of the identity tensor, as indicated here, and the coefficient effectively is a scalar Reynolds stress. That's pressure, a turbulent pressure, effectively. The capital T stands for turbulence, whereas capital G before we're standing for the gas.
The equation of state that you have here, is that kind of a generalization of the equation of state for ideal gas?
It's simpler than that. It's a polytropic gas for constant gamma is what it really amounts to. I think it is an ideal gas indeed, but ideal gases could have somewhat more complicated equations of state, I believe.
Okay, well, if you replace the internal energy by C sub B times the internal times the temperature, you get these little rho RT.
Right. Yeah. This is essentially TV equals the energy density, or RT.
Right.
So, come back to the generic constant. It's a constant. Treated as a constant. For a monatomic gas, it's 5/3. For a diatomic one, it's 7/5. For gas with no internal degrees of freedom, it's 5/3. If there are internal degrees of freedom, then that can change. For example, the atmosphere, those molecules have internal degrees of freedom, so that's like in the atmosphere, for example, the equation of state effectively is gamma law is gamma equals 7/5. So, what about an equation of state for turbulence? That's what I'm moving toward here, effectively. Specific turbulent kinetic energy, of course, is given by an expression of this sort, where these are the velocity components. And this is essentially equal to a turbulent pressure times Kronecker delta tensor, divided by 2 rho. This is essentially coming from the thing that was on the previous new graph. And effectively, then, this is an expression for the turbulent kinetic energy in terms of the turbulent pressure. And therefore, one can immediately deduce the turbulence equation state analogous to the gas equation state is given by, I guess you'll get out of your way, is given this way, essentially by looking at this expression. It gives a turbulence pressure in terms of the density and the turbulence kinetic energy.
It's all kind of superficial, or there is something behind? Because, I mean, would you think thermodynamically you would define pressure in relation to energy as variation of volume gives you work done by this pressure? So this would work?
Or I'm going to go on. We can. I'm going to follow those consequences immediately, very soon. But in particular, then, what this says is that if we treat this as a gamma law, that essentially is defining a gamma for turbulence is this way. A gamma for turbulence, which, as you look at back at this thing, is equal to 1 plus 2 over d, where d is a dimensionality. 2 or 3 are the interesting cases.
You mentioned with monatomic turbulence.
Yeah. Well, it's like...
Like monotonic gas.
Much like monotonic gas. So it is 5/3 for d equals 3. And it's equal to 2 for d equals 2, which is the other interesting case.
This is going to have all the usual disclaimers that we make when we try to treat turbulent like a diffusion process.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. Absolutely. Well, in particular, consider this case where, in fact, you have a gamma law gas which has a gamma of 5/3. That's the gas setting. But it's turbulent, and that we just saw also has a gamma of 5/3 for homogeneous isotropic turbulence. And therefore, the turbulence gamma and the gamma of the gas are the same, both 5/3, so we can lump them together. The Reynolds analogy is sometimes referred to. That is, treating the turbulence as molecular motion. Not generally valid, but in this particular case, it is valid. And so one has a total equation of state for the turbulent gas by essentially adding together the pressures from the turbulence into the gas. And the energy, internal energy from the gas, kinetic energy from the, which is like an internal energy for this thing, to get a total energy and a total equation of state. An equation of state for the sum of the internal properties, molecular motions, and the turbulent eddy motions. So now we start worrying about the thermodynamics. We have a thermodynamic work equation, effectively. A change in the energy is given by minus PdV work term, effectively. V being the specific volume, that is, it's the inverse of the density. And let's take the simplest example of doing work on this gas by essentially having an adiabatic, isotropic, spherical compression of this mixture of turbulence and gas, as it were, or turbulent gas, and the pressure is given by this equation state for the combined. So effectively, the appropriate equation relating the total quantities is given by minus 2/3 E over V times V, or we can integrate this effectively, as shown here, to get what happens to the total energy in the final compressed or expanded state from an initial value as a function of the change in the specific volume or the compression factor, where the rho is the inverse of V, and so that's a plus 2/3 here, minus 2/3 here. But the amusing thing is that although I've been talking about a slow compression or expansion of this gas, the result that I've just got from this kind of gas dynamic analysis is exactly the same as one would have got by rapid distortion theory. Well, this is the result that I got just from doing slow work on this system. And now I'll show you the argument for the distortion theory.
So the thermodynamic relationship at the top, it has, I'm trying to remember what the constraints are. It's only for isentropic compression or expansion, that one on the top? Is that
this correct? I don't believe so. It's essentially work.
Well, but the left-hand side is internal energy.
Yes.
So if all of the work goes into internal energy, then there's no heat transfer. It's adiabatic.
That's
so
right.
Isentropic.
That's
so I guess we're all strictly isentropic.
That's right. That's right.
So there's an analogy between the adiabatic compression, which has to act quickly, and rapid distortion.
There's rapid distortion theory, which is quickly acting, and adiabatic, which is slowly acting.
I think adiabatic is fast. Otherwise, the boundary is unabsorbed.
I'm thinking about the interior of the gas, right? But what about rapid distortion theory? Of course, rapid distortion theory is appropriate when the distortion is so rapid, in fact, that nonlinear interactions, the eddies are rescaled in place. They're faster than the nonlinear interactions, so that the eddies are rescaled in place by these simple scaling arguments. And the way those arguments go, essentially, is that when you have compression by a factor eta, the final density over the initial density, quantities are rescaled by factors. Length, for example, not surprisingly, in a three-dimensional compression, is rescaled by the minus one-third power of the compression. Thanks to Kelvin, the circulation doesn't change in this change. That's essentially Kelvin's theorem. And circulation has these dimensions, so in the scaling argument, this is the thing that we turn to for an indication of how to relate the length scale changes with the time scale changes. The vorticity, which is circulation per unit volume, per unit area, circulation per unit area, is therefore given a scale by looking at these two things as eta to the two-thirds power. Time scales inversely with vorticity, so that's eta to the minus two-thirds power, and the total energy scales like eta to the two-thirds power if you look at the various dimensions involved here. And that's exactly the scaling that we were talking about in the
continue the analogy with the isentropic process, which says that all the compression work goes into changing internal energy. None of it goes into heat transfer, none of it goes ultimately into dissipation. It all goes into
dissipation. It's interesting here because dissipation of the turbulence goes into internal energy, so it doesn't change the total quantity.
Right, but it doesn't. There's no heat transfer. So now, with the rapid distortion theory, the idea is that all the compression work acts directly on the turbulent fluctuations, and there's no internal energy within the turbulence, sort of moving around within the turbulence.
The basis for rapid distortion theory is essentially that you rescale all the lengths and times appropriately.
Right. So the internal flux of energy within the turbulence is kind of analogous to the heat transfer in the thermodynamic situation.
Of course, an interesting case for which rapid distortion may not be particularly appropriate is the interaction of shocks and turbulence. Certainly a shock represents rapid distortion, but I think it's well known that there's some limitations in using rapid distortion theory in connection with treatment of shocks. But let me look at the shock problem. the jump conditions, Rankin Hugoniot jump conditions for a particular shock strength is indicated here, and the final pressure divided by the initial pressure as given by, and the ratio is given by the quantity pi. For gamma equal 5/3 is known to be given by with our compression essentially is given by this expression. And the ratio of the final energy and the initial energy is given by this ratio, where pi, as I said, is the ratio of the pressures, eta is the compression. But there is a interesting question about how energy is partitioned after a shock runs through a turbulent fluid between the gas and the turbulence. Has to do with the question of how much of the extra energy of the Hugoniot jump condition goes into the turbulent kinetic energy compared to how much goes into the heating of the gas. And there's certainly one limit that you could estimate from all of these arguments. If the pressure jump is smoothed sufficiently by turbulence, then of course you would argue that the gas compression is adiabatic, because it's a smooth compression of the gas, effectively. Slow compression of the gas.
What does that mean, the pressure jump is smooth?
If you have run a shock through turbulence, you might well imagine that the shock, instead of being sharp, jump, will in fact be rounded out and smooth. That's what's meant by it. There is experimental evidence for this when you run shocks through turbulence. One of the most, used to be one fairly frequent anyway, observation by any of us were sonic booms. That's a shock coming down from a supersonic aircraft down through the turbulent atmosphere, and it gets smeared out. That's why it's called a boom instead of a crack, I guess.
But that would be for low Mach numbers.
Yeah.
Probably statement is not true at higher Mach numbers.
These, I'm sorry?
At higher Mach numbers, I think the molecular aspects are still there. I think there's only smoothing
by turbulence.
Yeah. Just to shut, but here.
That's a serious question about exactly what the shock running through turbulence, what that structure looks like. It tends to at least get shattered into some subshocks, so that the overall compression is closer, I think, to being adiabatic. But
when the shuttle comes down, it's really sharp.
Yeah.
This is all relative. What do you mean by sharp? What do you mean by smooth?
Right.
You have to relate it to some other scale. The question is, what is the appropriate other scale? To say the shock width is where the mean-free path. Okay, that's sharp,
right,
in
that's
context
sharp.
With any macroscopic scale,
right, okay.
And not just smoothed over, say, by an integral scale, which is what you would expect turbulence to do, then it's obviously much bigger than a mean free path, but how smooth is smooth enough to claim that it's adiabatic?
There is experimental evidence on this, of course. It comes from essentially from supersonic flow with tunnels with a wedge in it, so that the shock is set up, and then you can watch the flow of it. Turbulence, pre-formed turbulence in the flow across the shock front, and it's studied experimentally. But it turns out, of course, that according to the arguments I'm just making, the gas final energy to initial energy is essentially given by an adiabatic compression, whereas the total has therefore to be extracted from the differences of these things. And this is tending to dump a lot of the extra energy into the turbulence as compared to putting it in the gas, which is only effectively being adiabatically compressed.
You seem to be ignoring the mean flow in all of this. And some of the kinetic energy is going to go into the mean flow. I mean, the Rankine conditions are for the total velocity jump across the shock.
Right.
And I don't think they say anything about turbulence versus non-turbulence. So there'll be a change of kinetic energy, total kinetic energy.
But it's based on...
Go into the turbulent part of that, go into the mean.
But the Rankine-Hugoniot conditions are essentially based on conservation of energy.
Right.
And in this case, it has to be treated, thought of as the energy of the turbulent part as well as the molecular motion.
Total energy.
Total energy. Uh-huh.
But that includes the mean. And you don't seem to be thinking about the part that goes into the mean in your discussion.
Isn't that the awkward question of how you define energy? That's a frame-dependent quantity, isn't it?
Well, you started with the Reynolds stress.
Yes.
The Reynolds stress is based on turbulent fluctuations.
Yes.
It's based on the concept of an ensemble mean.
That's right.
And you're sort of brushing the whole issue of the ensemble mean under the Reynolds stress.
Yeah. But essentially, you're moving into a frame with a mean flow, I think, in most of these discussions.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, in the frame of reference moving with the shock wave.
Well, everything I've talked about and shown here is essentially for three-dimensional turbulence, but two-dimensional compressible turbulence is of interest also. And in fact, my general plans are to examine a two-dimensional compressible turbulence in a numerical simulation to look at the consequences of some of these arguments and check out the consequences. But two-dimensional compressible turbulence is essentially a gamma equal two gas, shallow water. Stop and think about it. Shallow water effectively is a compressible two-dimensional fluid. And it turns out, according to Landau and Lipschitz, you can look at the derivation in detail, but it effectively has a gamma equal to two. Shallow water does in its dynamics. And so now, for that, the gamma of the turbulence, which as I mentioned before is 1 plus 2 over D, is also equal to 2. So again, the turbulence and the underlying fluid have the same gamma, 2 in this case. And you again can think of adding the two together looking at total quantities. But now, rapid distortion theory is also you can go through the rapid distortion theory arguments. The scalings are somewhat different, of course, because the length scale is 8^-1/2, not a third, as before. This is in two dimensions. Circulation, again, of course, by Kelvin theorem is invariant. The vorticity is given, again, by this, given by this now, because of the difference in the length scale scaling, and time is given by the inverse of eta. The total energy scales like eta, which incidentally is eta to the gamma minus 1, which was for gamma equal 2, and it was the same thing for the other case that we were looking at. So this really more or less, this essentially concludes what I wanted to say about this subject. I just wanted to point out that shallow water simulations are a lot cheaper than three-dimensional compressible turbulent simulations in numerical, in a non-arithmetic, needed to be done for a given resolution. And I'm currently involved in essentially setting up a numerical simulation of shallow water. I already have a numerical algorithm which is based on work that's been done in the atmospheric sciences community, where they deal often with quasi two-dimensional flows, which has the properties of has a lot of conservation properties built into it, which should make it nice for studying this sort of a system. So that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Any more questions? Do you have any sense for where this is going to lead? sort of goal.
The question is whether I'm more interested in the two-dimensional case or the three-dimensional case, and I'm not sure exactly yet. The three-dimensional case is related to, of course, turbulence modeling, clearly. In particular, this has to do with the details of this anchor K equation. In the epsilon model, for example, this has to do with the nature of the K equation. But there aren't very many mysteries about the K equation compared to the epsilon equation. And so I'm not sure that it's going to help very much there. But it does also, as I say, shed some bearing, perhaps, on how one looks at and treats two-dimensional turbulent flows.